Beginning in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. For the first week of October 2004, this is the Rain Report. I'm Norm Seeley, KI7UP. Outside of engineering circles, Fred Terman has never been a household name. He's credited with being the father of Silicon Valley, the man who put Stanford University on the engineering map, and a ham who made his mark in his World War II radar countermeasures research. Fred Terman's life and historical impact have been chronicled in a CQ magazine article in its October 2004 edition. The author is no slouch in his own right, university professor and engineer Stuart Gilmore, W1FK. We begin part one of Hap Holly, KC9RP's interview with Professor Gilmore about this intriguing man with his description as to just who Fred Terman was.
Fred Terman was a man who built Stanford University in the 50s and 60s from a respected regional university to one of the world's leading universities. If anybody is the father of Silicon Valley, it's Fred Terman. Among others, he was the teacher of Hewlett and Packard and a number of other very successful engineers. He was McGraw-Hill's leading technical textbook writer in the 30s and 40s and into the 50s with the five textbooks. And he really was a booster of the West Coast as against the power of the established elite in the East Coast. And he was president of the Institute of Radio Engineers in 1940-41, and for CQ Magazine, the recent article in the current October issue, I take a part of the book I've written on Fred about when Fred was directing Allied radar countermeasures from a secret laboratory at Harvard with over 800 employees. Fred had been a ham radio operator since he was 13 years old. He was born in 1900, and he held several radio calls before World War I was over. Thus, his career, as he advanced through electrical engineering graduate school at MIT, he was the first doctoral candidate of Vannevar Bush, who was the leading science administrator in World War II. Bush oversaw everything, the atomic bomb, radar, and so Fred had long contacts with him. Then Fred rose up through the electrical engineering and radio engineering profession and was president of the Institute of Radio Engineers in 1941. So when the U.S. entered the war, within 3 weeks after Pearl Harbor, a meeting of Navy and government officials decided to ask Fred to come back to Cambridge, Mass., and to set up a countermeasures radar unit, at first within the MIT radiation lab, and then as soon as they could move out, they moved across the river to Harvard. And Fred was thus the country's probably best-known radio engineer at that time, and countermeasures, first starting against German radar, needed somebody who had wide contacts across the radio engineering and television engineers and high-frequency electrical engineering community. The British radars in the chain home system that they began using during the Battle of Britain were around 40 megahertz, but the Germans were using gun-laying radar, that is, radar to direct anti-aircraft fire onto airplanes or even onto ships and so forth. They had a number of radars in the frequency range of 300 to 600 megahertz. Vacuum tubes that could put out any power in 1940 were very few above about 400 to 500 megahertz. You could just get out a few watts. The cavity magnetron had just been brought over secretly from England and was the focus of work at the Rad Lab. And the klystron tube, which had been invented at Stanford by the Varian brothers and William Hansen, was just also being developed. But German radar was still in the frequency range of 300 to 600 megahertz, and the task of Terman's group was, what devices do we have to cable together to defend successfully against this radar? Are there radars on microwave frequencies? No one knew. And what is going on in the Pacific? What radars are being used by the Japanese? And no one knew yet in very early 1942.
Let's define the basics of what radar is and how it's created.
Okay, well, as the late Henry Gerlach, who was the Radiation Labs historian, wrote many years ago, radar basically was the principles from the ionosphere radio people sort of taken up to higher frequencies. Just after World War I, several people tried to see if you could either have a differential frequency addition and subtraction effect on radio waves going to a particular other spot and have constructive or destructive interference, or, as was done at Johns Hopkins in 1925, actually send pulses up and also along the ground from Washington, D.C. across to the Navy base and see if one could measure, in fact, was there some kind of refracting or reflecting layer above the Earth. This had been predicted back in 1902 to explain why it was that radio seemed to be able to go around the Earth instead of light just going in a straight line. Well, the ionosphere radar people, and hams were in the middle of this stuff too, by 1930s, when a number of countries tried to use some method to detect airplanes for safe landing in fog or storms, but also detecting planes which might be danger, or detecting ships. And so they took over the ionospheric recording system, which was used really for radio weather and trying to study the ionized layers above the Earth, and tried to make the pulses shorter, the antennas hopefully smaller so they could rotate and thus have better target discrimination, and that required going up in frequency. So from about 1935, when they started trying to turn ionospheric transmitting sounders into radar, they had 200 microsecond pulses, antennas, you know, on the frequency of 30 or 40 megahertz. And so they tried to get up in frequency, up in power, and there were a lot of problems with this. But by 1939 or so, they had 20 microsecond pulses. We're working on radars that were in the 500 megahertz range. So while the radiation lab at MIT was developing all sorts of higher frequency radars, Fred's group was trying to defend against whatever the enemy forces would be doing in radar techniques.
Did he actually have to travel to Europe to do this, or was he able to pretty much stay stateside?
He did make one secret trip early in 1942 to Britain, where he visited the major British radar research centers and communication centers to take notes of all their stuff. He had a couple of other field sites in the U.S., particularly a big one down in Florida, where they did lots of flyovers and tried out stuff. But his younger staff were pretty much all over the globe where the Allies were. They were in North Africa, they were in Sicily. They had a site later in England with about 85 people. They had people flying over the hump in the China-Burma-India theater. So pretty much anywhere where the U.S. Navy or Army Air Force was, these guys had observers who were technical observers. They had a number of airplanes called ferrets or porcupines. Porcupines tended to mean jamming airplanes with up to 15 or more jamming transmitters to jam on the frequency of the radars. Ferrets were the opposite. Ferrets were B-24s or B-17s, which were loaded with search receivers, and they were searching for any frequency that they might detect radar pulses on. Early in the war, they sent one on a crash basis to the Aleutians to figure out which of the Aleutian Islands the Japanese had taken and how many people might have been there, or by the radar, was it any of it directed against ships or whatnot. So in a secret mission, that bomber flew out with a dozen or so receivers on it and antennas trying to find out what was going on. In fact, I've got some government photos of early equipment, and one of your recent programs talked about Halicaster's radio. The S-27 was used by the British in their search receivers in the late 30s. Among the U.S. efforts beginning in 42, the early shots inside the B-17s, these were manually tuned receivers. And then later there were automatically tuned ones and ones which could shift frequency quickly. And quite a bit of receiver design went on during World War II to perfect the countermeasure stuff.
I'm speaking with Stuart Gilmore, W1FK, whose article about Fred Terman, pioneer in radar countermeasures in World War II, appears in the October 2004 edition of CQ Magazine. We'll be right back. This is the Rain Report.
You're listening to RainReport.com, the only authorized internet source for Rain audio.
Their two greatest inventions, at least as I write about them in the book, were not the most sophisticated of their inventions, but one, the carpet jammers, which there were thousands made, were 5 to 15 watt jammers in the 450 megahertz range that were mounted on the planes, and the bombers might have several of these, and they could tune them to different frequencies as they would detect the German radar. In addition to the jammers, there were aluminum dipoles out of paper called chaff by the U.S. or window by the British. This stuff was dumped out of bombers, hundreds of pounds of it, by the end of the war. And so if a flight of 200 bombers was coming over the European continent, say, by 1944, it looked like there might have been 2 million planes coming over. And so the German radar oscilloscope screen would just be totally covered with noise, reflecting back their own radar transmitted signal from all of these little aluminum dipoles which were floating down. The Japanese were using 100 megahertz radar late in the war, as well as microwave radar, it turns out. So they had stuff called rope, which was aluminum dipoles strung end to end on a piece of string that was 400 feet long. They had all sorts of methods so that when it went out of the bombers, the aluminum didn't just fall as a fistful, that it separated into little pieces. So between search receivers on the snooper planes called ferrets and planes or ships loaded with jamming transmitters, all of this aluminum foil chaff, there is one captured German photo which shows the distance out to a flight of airplanes. And with no aluminum foil chaff falling, it looks like the planes are 8 to 9 kilometers away. And then the same German radar scope, after the chaff was turned on, it looks like the planes are from 1 kilometer to 30 kilometers out, as if the sky is just full of them. So where are they going to shoot? It's estimated that German's people saved about 800 Allied bomber crews with their efforts.
What were the most vexing challenges German encountered in achieving microwave radar?
German didn't work on microwave radar. His group worked on countermeasures. The Red Lab did most of the radar. The challenges for that were the cavity magnetron was not tunable in frequency. It could put out tremendous power. As the war went on, the Klystron tube was tunable in frequency and used as local oscillators and stuff and receivers. Red Lab at MIT, which had 4,000 people at its peak, was turning out literally hundreds of different devices that were 10-centimeter, 3-centimeter radar, and you got wonderful target discrimination, you know, almost photographic maps from such high-frequency radar. Terman's group were trying to develop search receivers for that and jammers for that, but the enemy never really had any kind of microwave radar to speak of during the war, so his stuff was nearly all below 600 megahertz. Now, all this work did lead to an explosion in microwaves after the war, and the Stanford people who developed the Klystron went back to Stanford and formed the microwave laboratory. So the basis of microwaves there then turned into SLAC, the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, the 2-mile-long linear accelerator, which was completed in the 60s. But that all grew out of the development of the Klystron.
You talked about the Porcupine that had a lot of jamming transmitters. At what point did those overtake any use of those aluminum dipoles that were dropped earlier in the war?
Actually, they used them both, and the aluminum dipoles weren't dropped earlier in the war because Terman's attempts to practice on them in North America were shut down because, in one case, it's never been publicized. They dropped them across some power lines in Boston and blew out a neighbor power supply, and the military was deathly afraid that the enemy would discover your newest device. So if it landed on the ground, they would now know what you were doing. In the same way that proximity radar actuated anti-aircraft was kept out of the war until late because it was feared if one of the shells didn't go off and fell to the ground, the Germans would figure out the little radars that were in the nose of each shell. So the chaff or window, the aluminum stuff, had been around in various shapes. It turns out after the war, several countries had it, but either they didn't design it very well, but they were afraid to use it because it would be so easy for the enemy to see, aha, here's this stuff falling down from the sky, now I know what it is. The British dropped some in early 1942, or maybe even in late 1941, 8.5-11 sheets of paper. On one side of the paper, they put propaganda stuff, so if the Germans found it, they would think it was propaganda leaflets. And the other side was aluminum foil, but they quit that. What Terman's group did that was really valuable was Fred Whipple, an astronomer who passed away in early September 2004. Fred Whipple took the calculations of a guy named Chu, perhaps the best mathematical antenna theorist in the United States, who was at MIT. Chu had calculated cross-section radar returns for all sorts of geometrical shapes. Then it was so secret they had to lock it away in Fred's safe, and he wasn't allowed to develop it some more. Then after a few months, Whipple got to thinking about it and looked at this and realized what was significant was not the most effective dipole, but what was significant was the most effective cross-sectional radar return per pound of aluminum. It didn't matter the shape of the dipole. What mattered was the weight the plane had to carry. How could you get the maximum radar reflection? And it turned out just cutting little thin dipoles, and in practice, they varied in length, but they were about a 16th of an inch, a little, like a little piece of angle iron made out of aluminum foil. They were about 15 or 16 inches long and perhaps a quarter of an inch or less bent into this angle shape. And it was cleverly done. One of Fred Terman's old friends, who was also a Stanford electrical engineer, a guy named Elliot, Harold Elliot, had designed push-button car radios in the 20s and early 30s. He'd sold a lot of those to Galvin, a later Motorola, and to Zenith. He came on board as a kind of electrical and mechanical engineer, and he figured out a way by taking a little flywheel on a motor and making alternate teeth on this thing, a sharp tooth and then a dull tooth. And as the aluminum sheets came along on these little sort of cutting lathes, the sharp tooth would cut it, the dull tooth would bend it into a right angle, then the next tooth would be the sharp one and it would cut it again. And they had Reynolds Aluminum did it, they had shoe companies making the boxes. There was a tremendous production of this stuff in the United States, and then eventually they flew some of these machines over to England, and they were making them over there too. Finally, by the end of the war, the big bombers were taking about 80 to 100 pounds per bomber per flight of this stuff.
This has been part one of Hap Holly, KC-9RP's interview with Professor Stuart Gilmore, W1FK, whose article about engineering pioneer and writer Fred Terman can be found in the October 2004 issue of CQ Magazine. We'll conclude this interview next time. Many thanks to CQ Communications for underwriting audio bandwidth for these Rain Reports. Their assistance allows us to archive the previous week's program on rainreport.com, and you'll find a link to CQ off the opening screen there. The Rain Report is copyrighted 2004. Rain, all rights reserved. Now for Rain's founder, producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Norm Seeley, KI7UP, bidding you very 73 from all of us at Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network.